This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man who strongly prefers to use the clean and unobtrusive Roboto regular font for body text. Ladies and gentlemen, the Captain.
Yeah, get you some. It's good to be seen and good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
Today, we are still sipping on Seven Cities by Smart Mouth Brewing Company in Norfolk, Virginia. That's seven sips for every 7 minutes if you are keeping track at home on your True Crime Garage sip counter. Seven Cities is a beautiful golden lager, sure to fill any glass with crisp, refreshing goodness. Also, I can see from my friends on Untappd that this was the green beer for St. Paddy's Day at some of the finer establishments out there. Garage grade, 3.5 bottle caps out of 5. And here's some shout outs to some of the finer listeners out there. First up, a cheers to Robert E. Palma from Parts Unknown.
And a big we like your jib goes out to Beer Run Becky in Hillsboro, Oregon.
Next up, we have Mike from Toronto. And last, but certainly not least, Captain, we have a double-fisted cheers to Ken and Stuart from Fair Play, California. Everyone we just mentioned, they went to our website, truecrimegarage.com, clicked on the pint glass, and that helped us out with this week's beer fund. And for that, we thank you.
Yeah, say it with me. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run.
Beer run.
If you didn't know, you can listen to the show on YouTube, on the old YouTube. So make sure you go over to YouTube and subscribe to True Crime Garage TV, because it's on the TV, and that's enough of the business.
All right, everybody, gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. In May of 1984, the FBI received the following letter. I have been involved in espionage for several years. Specifically, I have passed along top-secret cryptographic key list for military communications, tech manuals for SAME, and intelligence messages. I didn't know that the info was being passed to the USSR until after I had been involved for a few years. And since then, I have been remorseful and wished to be free. Finally, I have decided to stop supplying material. My contact does not know of my decision. Originally, I was told I couldn't get out without approval. This was accompanied with threats. At any rate, the reason for this letter is to give you, the FBI, an opportunity to break what probably is a significant espionage system. I know that my contact has recruited at least 3 other members that are actively supplying highly classified material. If interested in this matter, you can signal me with an ad in the Los Angeles Times classified section under personal messages. What I would expect to cooperate is complete immunity from prosecution and absolutely no public disclosure of me or my identity. I will look for an ad in Monday's editions only for the next 4 weeks. This is True Crime Garage.
We were knee-deep in comparing the similarities, not only in victimology, but also the similarities of the specifics of the crimes themselves and the details within those crimes of the two unsolved murders of two Navy ladies in the early 80s. First, we had Pamela Ann Kimbrough, who was murdered in 1982, found on the Norfolk Navy base. And then we had in 1983, Carol Ann Molnar, whose body was found in a crevice of the seawall on that same Navy base. Both of these bodies, Captain, were found in the Navy Air Station portion of the base. So we have this situation where victims are attacked and murdered within the course of about 1 year's time, and their bodies turn up in roughly the same location. And we have investigators who are sitting there in 1983 searching for answers. And again, obviously looking at the parallels, drawing parallels between these two murders. In both cases, we are likely going to have suspects that are going to be persons that are close to the victim. You would expect that in any murder investigation. In these two cases, this story is a little different than a lot of true crime stories out there, where you talk about the husband did it, or the boyfriend did it, or the ex-boyfriend.
Or the wife did it.
Or the wife did it. Not all of you wives out there are perfectly innocent.
Yeah.
In this case, that was certainly looked at in both of these homicides. However, as our timeline continues and stretches out further, we are going to have some suspects in these two murders that will by far overshadow any of the suspects on the inner social circles of these two victims. One thing that will be difficult, or has become difficult as time has progressed in these cases, is some of the information out there. Carol Ann Molnar's case, while very intriguing, and again sharing similarities with Pamela Kimbrough's case, the reporting on Carol Ann Molnar's case over the years has, well, frankly, it's been bad. The initial reports that were coming out were giving us the details and the information that we needed to look at this story. The information that came out later, some of it's just wrong. And so when you start to cross-reference what we have, what information we know about in this case, you quickly start to go, well, some of this can't be true.
Right.
Heck, some of the reporting, and these are, I'm not going to name any names, but reputable or supposed to be reputable reporters.
Bloody duds.
Yeah, but I don't think they made anything up. Maybe they just got some bad information themselves. Or?
Got some bad hooch.
Didn't do what we like to say everyone should do, their due diligence.
Yeah, do your damn due diligence.
But in one report that has been widespread, this person gets the cause of death wrong for our victim, saying that she was shot, and we know that that is absolutely not the case. Carol Ann Molnar was strangled.
Both victims were strangled.
Correct. Unfortunately, Pamela Kimbrough drowned in that vehicle after the strangulation attempt. Let's get into one of the details that fascinated me about this investigation and potential evidence here. In Pamela Kimbrough's case, a big piece of evidence was the ski mask that was found inside her vehicle that was submerged into the water. Later reporting in Carol Ann Molnar's case would say that a ski mask was found in her car. Remember, her car was found 10 days after she went missing, February 6th, 1983, from the Galleon Club.
Yeah.
Her body's found May 1st at 10:30 p.m. in the crevice of the seawall on the Naval Air Station base. Reporting years later states that a ski mask was found in her car as well, drawing even more connections between these two cases. However, we were able to track down some information to suggest that that wasn't true, that there was no ski mask that was found in the back of Carol Ann Molnar's car. That what I think has happened here, Captain, because we have so many similarities in the victimology, and all of this took place within about a year's time in the early 80s, I think that somehow these cases, it's like a game of telephone, where one person tells somebody something, you tell another, and you tell another, and you tell another, and then that story changes and tweaks a little bit, a little bit, a little bit more each time that it goes down the wire. I think somehow these two cases have kind of been meshed together over the years, where some of the details from one of the cases just spill into the narrative of the other.
Seems reasonable, or seems likely.
Well, and we know this to be the case here because, again, back to the ski mask. That is such a big part of the Pamela Kimbrough case.
Right.
It was reported later that a ski mask was found in the back of Carol Ann Molnar's car. No, we have police on record. We have authorities on record saying, when asked about the ski mask, saying there was no ski mask in Carol Ann Molnar's car. The only thing we found in her car was her shoes. Based off of the description, while they never say it, it sounds to me, Captain, like, unfortunately, remember we get the description of what she was wearing when she went into work that Friday night?
Right. We get the description of what she was wearing from her roommate.
The description of the shoes found in the car sound very similar to me of the description that we hear from the roommate of what she was wearing going into work.
Not only are you a computer expert, but you're also a female shoe expert.
Like Al Bundy.
Let me play devil's advocate here just for a second. Is it possible that some of these reports that are, they seem like misinformation, is it possible that they got some insider information from law enforcement or possibly from the Navy and they released this information, but this is actually holdback information from law enforcement?
Some of it could be holdback information. Here's where I think that the reporting got bad. I think that if I were to pick up the phone and reach out to a few different names of people that are on my notes here for these cases,
right,
and I call up and say, hey, and some of this did occur, but maybe not exactly in this manner. If I call up and say, hey, I'm calling from the New York Times, I'm calling from a paper, or I'm working on a project or a book, and I'm calling from afar, and I say, hey, need to talk to so-and-so. Oh yeah, what are you calling about? I'm calling about the sailor that was murdered and found on the airbase. Well, if you don't use the victim's name, you very likely could start getting details about the other case, because unfortunately, both of these women were found on the naval base. Both of them, unfortunately, were murdered.
Right.
And so I think that that is probably what happened. I think that they received some bad information because maybe they didn't ask the right questions. What did we learn from True Detective Season 4?
You keep bringing that show up.
I just love that they came up, you know, they presented this idea, which is so true in what we do here in the garage when we're researching these cases and exactly what detectives do. It's, you're only going to get the right answers when you ask the right questions. And the right questions, most of the time, are just not so obvious. Right questions, right suspects. Now, I don't know if we have the right suspects in both of these cases, but there are certainly some interesting suspects. And there are going to be suspects that will present themselves, put themselves on the radar, if you will, in both of these homicide cases. And these suspects will by far overshadow anybody on the inner social circle of these two young ladies. The first that presents itself, Captain, I wish we were just talking one-on-one right now, because I think you're going to love this portion of the story. So the first portion, the first potential suspect, or let's say suspects, right? It's a suspect pool here that we're going to present to you.
Right.
This pops up on the radar in May of 1984 on the other side of the country, out in San Francisco, California. And this is when correspondence, when a letter arrives to the FBI office out there, where the letter writer is confessing to committing espionage, but they are remaining anonymous. That is what you heard in the trailer at the start of this episode, is that letter from the unknown writer to the San Francisco FBI office. They received that in May. The person is stating, I've been committing espionage and I've been going against my country. I've been selling secrets to the Soviets and I feel bad about this.
Scumbag.
And oh, by the way, I'm doing it with other persons too. I've been making money off of this, but I'm willing to stop doing this. I'm willing to turn myself in and I'm willing to turn in my cohorts, but I would like you to show leniency, or I believe
that immunity
was the request. Now, I don't know that anybody would expect, you'd have to be a crazy person to expect to get full immunity on selling secrets to the Soviets.
Now, is the government or military allowed to say, yeah, we'll give you immunity, and then go psych?
Well, is the government allowed to lie? Is that what we're asking?
Don't get me started.
I'm going to go on record and say two things. One, I love our government. And two, not only are they allowed to lie, but they do it to us every day.
That's you love the ones that hurt you the most.
I just want them to know that I am a fan, so don't come after me. I've got other problems. I don't need the government on my back.
Yeah, every now and then I pick up my phone and I whisper into it, I love you, government. Please don't kill me.
The letter writer is trying to set up an exchange of communication with the FBI.
Yeah.
And saying, look, I'm going to, if you want to communicate with me, place an ad, a want ad, in the classified section of this specific newspaper, but only on Mondays. I will monitor it every Monday. I will monitor that section every Monday and look for you to communicate with me. Because what the letter writer wants is, hey, can you guarantee me this before I reveal myself to you? And the letter writer, while it's anonymous, they are calling themselves, I guess, Russ, or capital R, capital U, capital S. And so communicate with me via the classified section of this newspaper only on Mondays. And they do. There is some back and forth between the FBI and this Russ character. But at some point, the communication tapers off and the FBI walks away from this going, okay, what the letter writer is stating is so vague, we can't prove anything from what we've received from them that there's actual espionage or crimes being committed here. And unless this person continues to communicate with us, we don't fully know what's going on. But they can also gather from the communication that they think that, you know what, maybe Russ is getting cold feet and doesn't want to turn himself in.
Right.
So San Francisco's office is investigating this. The listeners will want to know that the letter, they did track down that the letter came from Sacramento. And I believe there were about 1.5 million people living in Sacramento at the time. So that's not of great help. And of course, just because a letter is mailed from there doesn't mean that one of the good people of Sacramento had to be the ones to mail that letter. Anybody can drive into town and drop something off in the mail slot there. We're going to fast forward a few months later, and we're going to go back to the other side of the country where we started, on the East Coast. This is
back to the East Side.
This is when the FBI gets contacted in September of 1984, and they're contacted by one Barbara Walker, and she is actually separated from her husband. Her ex-husband is John Walker. She calls up. I believe she might even have been quite intoxicated when she called up. But she calls up and she says, look.
Sounds like us when we do a podcast.
She calls the FBI and could be quite intoxicated. I don't know.
Hey, guys. I just want to call you to tell you this beer's good.
Well, she tells them that her ex-husband, John Walker, has been selling secrets to the Soviets for many years now and making a bunch of money off of it. Of course, the FBI, now they have to sort out, well, is this just an angry ex-wife who's trying to set up her husband for something?
Drunk out of her mind.
Or is this there's some smoke and plenty of fire situation? What makes this interesting to the FBI is John Walker himself worked for the Navy for many years, and he worked on submarines as well.
Yeah.
I don't have his exact rank in front of me here, but at this point in our timeline in 1984, who is John Walker? Well, John Walker, former naval officer. Oh, by the way, some of his work was out of the Norfolk area for the Navy. And then after he retired, he's still in that Norfolk, Virginia area, but he's running like a private investigator company. So he owns his own company, and they're fairly successful. They're not crazy big time, but they're fairly successful. She's accusing him of selling secrets to the Soviets. And what she says is that she doesn't know a whole lot about it.
Right.
He didn't like openly talk about this with her when they were together.
And if he did, she was drunk out of her mind
and forgot all about it.
But, well, he told me some stuff, but I just wasn't listening.
But she says that from her understanding, he started doing this when he was working for the Navy and then managed somehow to continue to do this even after he had gone on to create his own company, this private investigations company. She believes and tells the FBI that she believes that he had made over $1 million. And I think she referenced $1.5 million at the time of her call, which you go back to the early 80s and during his time in the Navy, which would have been in the late 60s and 70s, all through right. the 70s. That's a whole lot of cashola.
That's some cash. But the worst part about it is he never paid taxes on it.
Well, the worst part of it, and we shouldn't laugh because I don't know what exact information he had sold to the Soviets. In fact, it was later proven that he had sold it to the KGB. Without going through all of this, the saddest part of it is these secrets, this information may have killed some of our own men and women.
Yeah.
In the armed forces. So,
and that's not good.
Well, and that's why you can't take these things lightly, right? This espionage. And so now they're looking at this guy and they're trying to figure out, okay, is this just an angry old ex-wife coming after this dude, trying to set him up? And then one thing that they're starting to question too is, look, they spy on us, we spy on them. They know some things we do, we know some things that they do. And the FBI at the time and the CIA was working under this idea that maybe the story's not true because $1.5 million sounds like a lot of money. Like they had some evidence to suggest that the KGB didn't pay out that kind of money for secrets. Now, this $1.5 million was collected over a long period of time. To try to keep this story moving along here, Captain, because this John Walker story is huge. And it became a very big story in the mid 80s here in the United States. And parts of it got pretty sensationalized.
Wonky donkey, like we like to say.
But what we're going to have here is John Walker, plus the persons that were working with him to sell this information to the Soviets. This will go on to become what is now known today as the Walker spy ring.
Yeah.
So we got several people that are working together here and had done so for many years. And this is where it gets hard to try to separate what could be sensationalized about this Walker spy ring story and what could be truth that's just buried in the story itself.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, people started to wonder, well, if you have this amount of money exchanging hands, you have all of this illegal activity that's going on, all of this covering up and these shadowy figures, they started to wonder what else could persons in this spy ring be responsible for? What other crimes in the area could they have committed? Would they have murdered someone to shut them up? Or if somebody was on to one of them, would they have murdered them to keep them quiet? And that is how members of this Walker spy ring become suspects in the unsolved murders of Carol Ann Molnar and Pamela Kimbrough.
All right. I'm on the edge of my seat, drunk out of my mind, calling the FBI. What else do we know about this? I mean, okay, so these guys possibly were capable of murder. That doesn't link them enough for me to these cases. How are they linked to these cases?
So they're working in the area at the time, and then what we get is John Walker and his son. So he recruited his son, Michael, to join in on the spy ring activity. His son also worked for our government. I believe he was in the Navy as well. His daughter, Laura, he attempted to recruit her as well, Laura Walker. She was in the Navy as well. And she turned him down. She's like, no, I don't. I don't think she was aware that he was doing this until he offered to bring her in on it.
Right.
And she says, no, I don't want any part of this. But she doesn't go anywhere with the information. She doesn't take that information to anybody. It's the ex-wife, Barbara Crowley, who turns him in. They got divorced in 1976. She's phoning this in September of 1984. She says that she learned about this. She'd been sitting on this information for over 10 years.
Well, thanks a lot.
You're exactly right. While I do not appreciate that, I guess better late than never.
Yeah,
maybe. But
in her defense, okay, she learns about this information. Okay, well, how serious is it? How serious is this? And should I go to law enforcement? And how much danger will I put myself in by going to law enforcement? I mean, so in her defense, if I got some juicy information about some bad people, you have to then question, do you want to turn over that information and put yourself at risk?
Well, and it will turn out that the person that was remorseful, that wanted to come forward, that wanted to stop doing this, that was John Walker. So that letter that was received,
the anonymous letter,
Russ, came from Mr. Walker. Now, Mr. Walker, as we said, already recruited his son, Michael, who was involved. His brother was involved as well, who was also a military man. And then another guy by the name of Jerry Whitworth. He was a senior chief petty officer in the Navy.
And you never get into business with your brother.
Well, you have these four that are known to be doing this. He attempted to recruit his daughter, who said no. Later, when she's confronted by the FBI, she does tell them what she knows. Now, the wife, Barbara, the ex-wife, the way that she came to find out that her husband was working as a spy for the Soviets, she's sleeping with John's brother while they're still married. And it's John's brother that tells Barbara that, oh yeah, your husband's a spy. I'm a spy too, but don't worry about it. It's not that big of a deal. We're not selling crazy important information to the Soviets, and we're just making a lot of cash. In fact, he tries to sell it to Barbara as saying, like, a lot of people do it. There's a lot of people in government and in the armed forces that do this. It's not that big of a deal.
Oh, but this makes Barbara a sex spy.
I don't believe anything that the brother's saying. I don't think that many people in the government or in the military are, in fact, doing this. I think he was just trying to, Well, I think he's just trying to downplay it so that she doesn't run off to the authorities, and which we know that she did eventually. I think she could have been easily talked out of it. And again, I think she may have been intoxicated and full of anger when she chose to call it in, because we do have her on record later when her ex-husband, his brother, Jerry Whitworth, they're all busted. But keep in mind, all at the same time, her son is busted as well. Her son, Michael, who was doing this, was busted as well. And she did say on record after the fact, I would have never went to the authorities had I known Michael was involved. She didn't know, like she told the authorities, she didn't know everything that was going on, didn't have a great understanding of it. This is, I only know a little bit. Here's what I know. And she said that had I known that my son was doing this, I would have never turned him in. It was almost the perfect crime. Everyone was distracted, their attention elsewhere. Stacks of cold hard cash sitting on the table unguarded. Who wouldn't be tempted to slowly reach their hand out and steal a pile of Monopoly money from the banker? Monopoly is one of those games that can bring out everyone's most devious selves. And Monopoly Go takes that gleeful mischievousness to your phone in a wildly popular twist on the classic game that you can play throughout your day, anywhere, anytime. Collect rent from friends on iconic properties, bankrupt them by pulling a heist on their vault. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with friends to unlock big prizes and try to top the leaderboards. Whether you're helping out your friends or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is an absolute blast. Download it now free on the App Store or Google Play. Have you ever thought about why your wireless bill is so damn expensive? It's all just radio waves. And how much can radio waves really cost? It seems like big wireless all got together and decided $100 a month. Now, thanks to Mint Mobile, you have a choice. For a limited time, all phone plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. So ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal and get premium wireless for just $15 a month. I love Mint Mobile. They have great quality. They have wonderful service. I love saving money. Put them together and I'm getting great quality, great service, a wonderful phone plan for only $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options and more than 60 add-ons every week. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. Factor's ready-to-eat meals are on the table in 2 minutes. Eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff. Customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. They're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Day Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. I am always on the go. I'm rather busy. And grabbing a quick meal, for me, used to mean eating the bad stuff. But I've switched to Factor. Now I simply grab a Factor meal from my refrigerator, heat, and then I am enjoying a delicious meal in just 2 minutes, and it's not loaded with the bad stuff. Head to factormeals.com/truecrimegarage50 and use code truecrimegarage50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code truecrimegarage50 at factormeals.com/truecrimegarage50. 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
All right, we are back, you filthy sex spies. Cheers to you all. Tall cans in the air. Onward and upward.
Are there any sex spies that are not filthy? I think that's part of the...
Hey, I would love to be a filthy sex spy.
Well, the way that this all works here is we have another individual that is attempting to run guns. They're attempting to sell illegal firearms, and we're talking about by the caseload, my friend. Hundreds of thousands of dollars stood to be made by selling guns. What they're doing, Captain, is when they get onto this John Walker, this Walker spy ring, and the persons involved, the Navy and the FBI, very wisely, they decide, you know, we're not just going to kick in the door. No, we're going to surveil these guys for a while. We're going to see what they're up to. Let's see if we can find out exactly who they are working with and how they are going about this business of selling secrets to the Soviets. During the portion of this surveillance, they learn that Walker and his son and members of the spy ring, they like to do things like they act like to be kind of like flamboyant gangsters, right? Like have money, show that they have money, drive flashy cars, hang out with young women, party at night, go to these clubs. And that's where they think that there may have been some crossover between Carol Ann Molnar and a person or persons in this spy ring. Could she have been killed because she knew too much? And one thing that's really interesting is we talked so much about where her body was found. Her body was found not far from where one of the persons in the spy ring docked their boat. And I believe it was a houseboat. And we talked so much about having to have access to the naval base due to where our victims were found. But if water's involved, I don't know that you have to absolutely have full access to where Carol Ann Molnar was discovered.
Meaning
if you used a boat to place her where she was, I think you could get her to where she was found without being granted access to the base, where the opposite is the case for Pamela Kimbrew. Where Pamela Kimbrew was found and how the nature of that crime and that investigation, that person had to already be on the base to attack her and attempt to conceal the body.
I'm going to say something, and again, call me out on it if I'm dumb. A lot of similarities, right? If she made it back on the base, Carol, right?
Right.
They would have record that she made it back on the base, and then there'd be a record of what individual she was with.
And you would have to believe that either she did that without the use of her vehicle, or her and her vehicle made it onto the base and somehow somebody moved the vehicle off of the base, but not her.
Yeah, because I was just thinking, is it possible that she met somebody at the bar? They started heading in the direction back home. Things weren't going his way. But that's not possible, right? Because essentially, she's back on the base. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
She's found in the naval airspace. I'm sorry. She's found in the Navy air station portion of that base. Now, when we say seawall, it's my understanding, Captain, that they're talking about the seawalls that would separate, they kind of protrude out into the water.
Yeah.
What I'm getting at, if she's found on the outside of that, or if, and there's no nice way of saying this, if she was a floater, she could have either been placed where she was found, or she could have ended up where she was found after being just tossed into the water or disposed of in some other form or fashion. And I apologize for the crude remarks. And again, we don't have enough information, I think, to really decipher exactly how she ended up where she was. Where with the reverse is true with Pamela Kimbrough. We can say with near certainty that we understand how she ended up in the water. I mean, she was placed in her car in the back seat and that vehicle was submerged in the water. Her and her vehicle were on the base. Her and her vehicle were found in the waters of the base.
Right.
That's pretty simple to me. Somebody on the base that was there at that time of night or morning, we should say, it was roughly 4 a.m. when she was killed. They were able to narrow it down to about 4 a.m. on that fateful day. The issue here is, as said, these persons would frequent some of these clubs. There was also persons suggesting that maybe Carol Ann Molnar had some kind of, I hate to use the word relationship because people always jump to what that may mean.
Yeah.
But there is some information out there that says that maybe she had interactions with one or two of these guys, which would make sense if she works at the club and they frequent the clubs. There is information out there too that states that, okay, so we'll fast forward a little bit. This, again, this Walker spy ring thing was a big deal in the mid 80s. And as I said earlier, I believe it got very sensationalized. This was selling newspapers, and then later it's going to sell books. And one of the individuals that covered the case and wrote a book on the case states in his book and states in newspapers, I talked to NIS and they told me that, yes, these spy ring guys are suspects in three murders. The murders of Pamela Kimbrough, Carol Ann Molnar, the two victims that we've discussed at length, and also a Portsmouth, Virginia detective. Now, his death was actually ruled a suicide, but there were things at the scene that people thought didn't line up with a suicide. So Detective Joyner was found. The official cause of death ruled suicide. He had shot himself. But the way that the gun was found in his hand didn't make sense. It's like facing the opposite direction. He's holding it in his left hand rather than his dominant hand, his right hand. And that case has never really moved off of what it was ruled as a suicide. But you have persons that this author cites, private investigators, and nameless NIS workers or nameless persons, anonymous sources from the FBI, I believe is how they state it, that these men or one of these men in the spy ring is responsible for some or one or all three of these murders. What we do get, Captain, is years later. And I love when things get squashed, right? You gotta smash it. When it's just wrong, it's just wrong. You have the FBI that came out later and says, we've never openly said that we believe that these guys killed anybody, or in fact are even directly tied to these murders in particular.
What?
No, the FBI goes on record and says, we never said that. So what you have is you have somebody's lying. Either the author is lying or the FBI is lying. But, you know, the FBI
both have motives.
Well, the FBI isn't just one person. So if the author's lying, that author knows for certain. If it's the FBI, they may not know for sure. There could be somebody within their organization that sat down and had drinks with this author and said, oh, yeah, we were looking at these guys for murder, too. So here we sit with this interesting idea that one or somebody involved in the spy ring could have murdered one of these women or both of these women. it's easy to kind of connect the dots and say, okay, that makes some sense. But again, you have one source telling us, yes, this is true. There's some smoke here. And then you have another source, and that source being the FBI, saying, no, there is no smoke here.
The motherfucking FBI.
That is 1984. That is 1985. In 1985, to kind of sum up the Walker spy ring story, John Walker Jr. did plead guilty. He did a plea bargain with federal prosecutors, which he was forced to testify against his co-conspirators. And again, that included this Jerry Whitworth. It included his son, Michael Walker, and it included his brother. And John Walker, I believe, passed away in prison while he was serving his time. The next suspect falls onto the radar in November of 1985. This is a man that would go on to be known as several different names. We are choosing to call him the Florida Vampire. But this is a man who abducted a woman while he was living in Melbourne, Florida, in November of 1985. He holds her captive in his home, where he is, for lack of a better term, sexually torturing her for an extended period of time. Now, she gets lucky. And I say she gets lucky because she gets away. And I actually believe that this guy has got some victims that never got away.
Yeah.
The police and the FBI think so as well, because later they would tell us he needs to be a suspect in the unsolved murders of Pamela Kimbrew and Carol Ann Molnar. This man's name is John Brennan Crutchley.
The Vampire of Florida.
That's exactly right. So he abducted this woman during a time period when his wife and child were out of town. And if you believe some of the information in the Long Island serial killer case, you're immediately jumping and thinking to that case.
Yeah.
He abducts this woman. She gets lucky. She gets away. This guy has clearance, has military clearance. He didn't work for the military. He worked as a contractor for the military.
Mm-hmm.
He was an engineer. He was a systems engineer. He moved around a lot. And during the course of that moving around, he would work for some of these military bases. There's good reason to believe he lived in Norfolk for a while. What the authorities want to figure out, he moved. So from my understanding, Captain, he moved from Norfolk, Virginia, down to Florida in 1983, right? And we know that Pamela Kimbrew was killed in 1982 in Norfolk, Virginia, and we know that Carol Ann Molnar was killed in 1983 in Virginia. The problem with the Carol Ann Molnar case, as far as John Brennan Crutchley, Florida Vampire, goes, I can't figure out. I've not been able to find a definitive date of when he moves from Virginia in 1983 down to Florida.
Right.
What we do know is he did move in the course of that year. So if he moved prior to February 6th and was not in Norfolk, Virginia, then he could not physically be responsible for the Carol Ann Molnar case.
Yeah, or he was going back and forth and moved a little bit at a time.
So he is somebody that came onto radar and was being looked at, not just in these two homicides. We're talking about in many homicides. In fact, so many homicides that when you and I started looking at Crutchley, we decided this is too big of a story. We've got to take a look at this guy, put him under the microscope and see what else he could be responsible for. And I hesitate. I would like to tell the listeners, this is just the tip of the iceberg with this guy in this story. There is so much bizarre behavior, strange behavior, evil behavior about this guy that I hesitate to even start to go down that road. Because one thing that we need to discuss is that there was actually some justice for our victims. So while we sit here today, Captain, and we say, unfortunately, the Carol Ann Molnar case is still unsolved, the NIS, who was looking at the murder of Pamela Kimbrew, they got a huge break in 1995 in the case. That is when, and I'm happy to report this will be our recommended reading again for the second time, the Solving Cold Cases author, Joe D. Kennedy. So Kennedy was on the Cold Case Task Force. He was on the task force that decided to take a second look at the Pamela Kimbrew case. When he gets a hold of the file, he starts looking through the file and he realizes, wait a second, we've got a good suspect that's already in our file. She was killed in 1982. He's looking at this in 1995. The suspect is Richard Whittle. Richard Whittle had access to the base. In fact, he was out working that night, the same night that Pamela Kimbrew was killed.
And like we said, not only do they have to have access, but they also to have access at that time period of night.
So the Pamela Kimbrew case is discussed in his book, and that's another reason to pick it up. But the cool thing about his book is that you can apply it to any cold case and how you choose to look at the information that's out there and in the evidence that's out there in any cold case. Now, remember we said in the early weeks, after several weeks of work, NIS had reported to the newspapers that in the Kimbrew case that they had talked to 798 persons. They had interviewed 798 people about the case. And then later in 1995, Joe Kennedy, cold case expert, takes a look at it and he goes, wait a second, I think our guy is already somebody that we've talked to. He's already in the file. And that was that Richard Whittle who was working that night. And why does he hone in on Richard Whittle? It's because Richard Whittle told NIS one thing and told people he worked with another thing. He told the authorities, yeah, I knew who she was, but I never saw her. I didn't see her that night. I hadn't seen her in days.
Right.
Yet he tells other people that he worked with, yeah, you know, because it was something. I mean, if a person gets murdered, body found at the place where all of us work, of course we're going to talk about it.
Of course.
He tells these other people, well, yeah, not only do I, do you remember when that woman was killed? Oh yeah. Not only do I remember it, but, I was questioned because I was the last person, may have been the last person to see her that night. So that doesn't line up with what he's telling police. So if you are the detective, and forgive me if I slip and say police, we're so used to saying police, but NIS, when you tell a detective one thing and then other people something else, the detective immediately wants to know, he or she is, if they're a good detective, they're not going to immediately jump to, oh, Richard Whittle's the killer. No, they're going to go, he's a liar, but a lot of people lie, and right. I want to know why he is lying about this.
Yeah.
Does that make him my killer? He's living out in California in 1995. I'll back up the truck just a little bit here, Captain, because I have a suspicion about beep, this investigation. Beep, beep. Okay. I don't think that this cold case task force just happened to pick up this case file in 1995 and take a look at it.
Mm-hmm.
What was happening, what we do know was happening, was Florida authorities were taking a hardcore look at John Brennan Crutchley, Florida vampire, who's already locked up and in prison. They're taking a hard look at him in 1995. They reopened up their investigation on him, and they are going to other states where they know that he lived for a period of time, trying to find out if he has any other victims. One of those states they go to is Virginia. So I think that kind of kickstarted or maybe reinvigorated the investigation into these two cold cases. So
it makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, so in 1995, Richard Whittle's living out in California, and Kennedy is really darn good at what he does. So he flies out there with another detective and just plays dumb, right? Oh, yeah, we're out here. We don't, you know, your name was in, we're only out here because your name was in the file. We don't, you know, think you really have any information or any importance to the case, but we have to re-interview everybody, and you were interviewed before. And so, yeah, he says, yeah, I remember her and blah, blah, blah. And so the conversation has started. They have DNA in Pamela Kimbrough's case.
Dun, dun, dun.
Kennedy knows that. He's got to get Whittle's DNA. And then, oh, this guy is gross. This guy is disgusting. When they get out to California and find out what he's been up to, he's been kind of living two lives, right? On one hand, he's got a wife who I think required being taken care of. I think she had some health issues and needed a caretaker.
Right.
He's taking care of her, and they have a child together. But while he's out there, he gets in trouble for exposing himself to some people in the area. I believe he's even, I don't want to go into to what I know. We don't need to get into the specifics.
Which we know that's not good, because I've been told by law enforcement many times that I can't do that.
We know that this is type of behavior is going on. And if you want to take a look at Richard Whittle, it gets more gross than that. But to keep it short and not so sweet, he was exposing himself to persons.
That's what he called it, short and sweet.
Kennedy sends a female officer to Whittle's neighborhood under the ruse that she's out there conducting a survey of persons that live in the area. And, oh, would you fill this out while I ask you some questions? She's going door to door, knocking on doors. Would you fill this out while I ask you some questions? And, oh, by the way, we're going to pay you for your time. We'll pay you. And we just need you, when you're done with your questionnaire, just fold it up for me and place it in that envelope. But we need our envelopes to be sealed.
Right.
So we make sure that the right people get paid. So Whittle licks that envelope, seals it up, hands it back to her, and then off she goes.
Dumbass.
And of course, now it's only a matter of time before they're going to find out, does his DNA match the suspect DNA that they have in Pamela Kimbrough's case? And it absolutely does. But Joe Kennedy is, I don't want to use the Burrito Supreme reference anymore.
Yeah.
It's kind of played. It's kind of played. But since we entered Florida into the conversation, we will talk about, how about we use a reference that is more about Florida. So to the extreme, right? Vanilla Ice from Miami, Florida. So Joe Kennedy is detective to the extreme.
Yeah. Word to your mother.
He says, I got the DNA. And I could have this guy locked up right now. But you know what I want? That's not good enough. I want a confession. He brings him in, questions him, tells him we got your DNA, tells him that, oh, by the way, the ski mask that we found in the back of her car, we found your hairs in it. And we know that you knew her based off of our previous questioning. Guy breaks down and confesses. So Kennedy takes this from a cold case to a DNA confession case.
Wow.
Rather quickly. And this dude is locked up. He gets two life sentences, one for the rape, one for the murder of Pamela Kimbrough. Now you go, well, did he kill Carol Ann Molnar the following year in a case that has so many similarities?
Yeah.
What we do know about Whittle is we do know that he moved shortly after Kimbrough's murder. And like John Crutchley, we don't have that specific date. He could have moved beforehand. But what we do know is that it's been reported and it's been stated that the DNA in the Pamela Kimbrough case does not match the suspect DNA that they have in Carol Ann Molnar's case. We get one solved. That's a great start.
Right.
And I have every reason to believe, Captain, the Carol Ann Molnar case is active and that they are still investigating and still looking for her killer.
I want to thank everybody for joining us here in the garage each and every week. Make sure you subscribe to the show. Colonel, do we have any recommended reading for the beautiful listeners?
We have recommended this before, and of course, we have to recommend it again due to this week's Garage Conversations. So our recommendation is a book titled Solving Cold Cases, Investigation and Protocol by Joe D. Kennedy. Joe Kennedy is the cold case expert that solved the Pamela Ann Kimbrew cold case homicide and put a pervert, rapist, and murderer, Richard Whittle, where he belongs, and that's behind bars, removed from society. Learn just about everything there is to know about solving cold cases from one of the experts. This week's recommendation, Solving Cold Cases by Joe D. Kennedy. You can find that great title plus podcasts and documentaries on our recommended page, truecrimegarage.com.
And until next week, be good, be kind, be cool, and don't litter. We'll be right back.